Worth Repeating is made possible by series sponsorship from the 8020 Foundation, the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, and the Lifshutz Foundation.
Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the second part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Irma and Emilio Nicolas Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was serviced, stories about the jobs that we do while in service of other people. Can you think of a time that you were in service of someone else? Our next storyteller is Jade Ivara. Jade shares a story about a tough decision that would shape her career in many ways.
So, my whole family is military, and it made sense that at some point in my life, I would be military too. When I found myself on the edge of the West Texas desert for training, and I was bored to tears or stressed to tears, I tried to remind myself that I chose this for some reason. In West Texas, there's nothing to do. In the Army, there's less to do. You exercise, you go to class, you smoke a cigarette, get yelled at, go to Dairy Queen, repeat. Every day blends one into the other, but one weekend, I got some time to myself. And my ex floated into town, and then he floated out again. And I'm a responsible adult, so I took a plan B and I didn't think about it again. And then a few weeks go by, and I have no symptoms. But the way that animals can sense a natural disaster, I knew something was wrong. So me and my roommate, two delusional friends, run to CVS and we say, cool, we're gonna take this test and then we're gonna go to Dairy Queen and it's gonna be fine. I'm alone under the fluorescent lights, and I'm like, this is chill. This is okay. And then there's a blue plus sign staring at me. And we're in a staring contest, and I blink first, and then my roommate comes in, and she's like, it's negative, right? And I don't say anything. I just hold the test out. And she looks at it, and we look at each other, and I say, can we still go to Dairy Queen? And we lie to each other and we say, it's probably a false positive. You're so stressed out. I'm like, you're so right. It is. Almost in defiance, my body says, okay. And as weeks pass, I hope no one notices that I'm a middle of the pack runner and I'm solidly in last place now. And I'm dry heaving in the bushes because my classmates think that Axe body spray and deodorant are the same thing. And the cafeteria is serving shrimp again in the desert. I don't know where you got it. And I hope that no one notices that I can't take my top off in 100 plus degree weather because I can't button the top of my pants anymore. Through all of this, through the haze of Excel spreadsheets and death by PowerPoint and class and gym and everything else, I finally pass the classroom portion. And I'm like, cool, I can relax a little bit. But I know that I still have the field coming up, which is where you do the culmination of everything you've learned in class, but also camping. So I'm stressed out. I don't know what to expect. The night before we're set to leave, we're packing. And my platoon leader stops me. And he says, Ibarra, I need you to stay back for a little bit. Oh, shit. And he's like, he had these bright blue eyes that looked right through me. And he said, Ibarra, I want you to know that I know. And I play dumb. But then he asked me the question that I was not expecting at all, which was, are you okay? I've been better, but okay. And he's like, can you do this? And the truth is that I don't know. But we're going to find out. So the next day, it's 5 a.m. The heat is already ramping up. I've got an armor plate vest digging into my uterus. I've got a 40-pound, comically large rucksack. I've got a helmet on. I've got a weapon on. And it sounds really cool and tactical, but the truth is that I look like a Ninja Turtle, and and I'm upset. And then we set off into the darkness. And we're running for some reason, and it feels like you're sprinting in a dream where I just cannot move fast enough. And I'm like throwing up these wordless prayers to God. Please don't let me step on a rattlesnake. Please don't let me get a thorn through the bottom of my boot, through a foot, because I'd seen it happen and it's gross and it's painful. Please, God, don't let me fall backward on my rucksack and get stuck on my back like a June bug. But I don't. And finally, we make it to the end. The sun is rising and we've hit our objective point, which is just our camp. And I look over, we're all covered in sweat, and my squad leader is hunched over a cactus, puking his guts out. And I should be concerned, but all I can think of is, thank God, it's not just me. And we spend the next few days out there, maybe 20 MREs later, we're heading back. It's black flag weather, so it's too hot officially to train. We're not wearing our gear, we're just marching back, and everybody's got black spots in their vision. We're having to dunk our arms every mile in ice water to prevent heat stroke. But then, all of a sudden, I'm done. And I'd like to say that I was really hype and really proud of myself, but the truth is that I was a little bit more concerned about other things, and all I wanted to do at this point was just get home. Okay, cool. I've accomplished this, and that's great, but I have other things to worry about. So I finally get home, and I schedule my appointment to confirm that there was really a pregnancy, but 2 weeks later, the same way that you just know things are not going well, I went to the ER, and I waited 6 hours for them to tell me what I already knew, which is that I had been pregnant, I was right, but that I had also lost it. And they all told me this in the same breath. And I never regretted my decision to stay. I always felt that that was the only choice. There was nothing without that. That was what I came for. But I went back and forth wondering if I could have done something different, until the doctor said it wouldn't have mattered what you did. It was always going to happen. You were just, and I quote, unlucky. And I felt unlucky for a while, but I realized that my choice was mine and no one else's. And under pressure, you make a decision and then you live out that decision for better or worse. And it brought me here. So thank you for listening. I appreciate you.
This is a big story. Thank you for sharing your choice, Jade.
This program was made possible with support from the 80/20 Foundation, striving to transform San Antonio by issuing grants to public charities that attract, grow, and retain San Antonio's future workforce. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Worth Repeating returns this fall, and I want to hear from you. Take some time and tell us what you thought of this past season. Suggest some themes for next year, or maybe just give us our flowers. Visit tpr.org/WR and fill out the survey today. Not a survey guy or gal? You can shoot me an email directly at worthrepeating@tpr.org. Our next storyteller is Nico Garza. Nico shares a story from two different kinds of kitchens with a couple of tips.
These guys are great, by the way. They're legends. I look up to them. Wow, there's a lot of you out here, and I'm not really prepared. Pretty behind. That's what a bad chef would say during a busy night, because he's just oblivious to the situation that he's getting himself into. Obliviousness is kind of the theme of this whole stories I got to tell. The first one starts at a coffee shop I worked at. They were pretty cool. It's a university coffee shop by UTSA. And if you've never worked in coffee before, it's your main job is just be cool. And that's kind of what we were doing this Friday. It was a slow start, trying to pick some music out. And, you know, I was really into some psychedelic rock at this time, some real fuzzy, grungy guitar music. It's also getting into Sade and some sexy music. I'm glad I did not play this sexy music for what was about to happen. Because it would have made the thing a lot more uncomfortable for us. I was making these drinks, taking some orders. Wasn't very busy, like I mentioned. And we looked to the table right in front of the espresso machine. And we noticed this probably football player. I don't know what he was going to the university for. He was studying his Bible, which is why I assume he was an athlete of the university. This man had his the head of his penis sticking out of his shorts. And I really didn't know what to do. I was the younger of the two on the staff, making these drinks and pouring these beautiful crafted lattes. And I was the one that was forced to, you know, tell him. At the time, I was also, you know, into the psychedelic rock. I was also into abstract expressionism. So I drew a picture in the style of Willem de Kooning. No, I actually wrote him a note saying, hey, you're having a wardrobe malfunction. Like, you should really take care of this. And he did. I didn't see his balls, but he had bigger balls than mine because he went to the restroom and came back and continued to study his Bible, which, again, big balls. We continued our day, and it was starting to get a little busier. A line started to form, and tickets started flowing. I had to make a choice because his penis popped back out of his shorts. I had to make a choice to either make these people their drinks, and as a hospitalitarian, I really wanted to focus on the people in line, but I also didn't want them to have to see somebody's penis. So I went around and I stood in front of the table and I looked at him. I was like, how do you not feel that? Because if we were playing our Sade or our Tame Impala, it would be loud. And it was also a pretty cold place. And that's why I asked, like, how do you not feel this? And again, he was very embarrassed. And I really, I fell for him. But this time he didn't go to the restroom. He fixed it right in front of me, which I think was a little weird. He ended up, you know, leaving us a nice tip. As well as dropping a 20 for us, which is like probably 5 lattes, I think. Man, that's an example of somebody being so oblivious, like as a patron. I have seen so many, and I have been an oblivious person in the kitchen. And there was a time where I was feeding into obliviousness during brunch. If you like brunch or hate brunch, this story is equally as divided. It was a time where I had a pretty cool brunch because it was slow and it was the summer and nobody wanted to eat on our hot patio. I was eating my chicken and waffles. I was also drinking some bubbles. I think it was Prosecco. Whether it's Prosecco or champagne, you should never add orange juice or any juice to your bubbles because that's immature. You should grow up. Feel the same way about pho. Don't put fucking hoisin and sriracha in your pho. Just grow up and dip. Add your seasonings it later. Anyway, I was eating my chicken and waffles, drinking my Prosecco. My chef comes up to me and wants to have a meeting about the next week of, you know, how we can be better. How we can spatchcock a chicken better or make our sauces, more flavorful, order better. And I was listening, but all the while, right behind her, a guy was having a stroke. And that's why I say this story so divided, because my two other coworkers, we were acting like we were in the back of an elementary school, like fifth grade class, and the teacher was having the worst day of her life, and we just wanted to laugh so hard because of her obliviousness to the situation behind her. We could have been better about telling her, but again, she was so passionate about how we could be better, and that kind of has made me better as a chef in a way. But it was a little bizarre when she's telling us how to be better, and this guy starts to vomit on himself. 5 minutes later, starts to piss himself, and we're still not sure if we should cut her off, tell her what to do. I noticed he was also eating the chicken and waffles, and I got a little scared because we did good quality stuff, but that was happening so slowly. And I start to notice, you know, other guests bringing him water, bringing him ice, trying to make him feel better. I also noticed a doctor who was a regular of our not only dinners but brunches slowly sneak out like this. And this was probably 10 minutes before the ambulance pulled up. When the ambulance pulled up, the stretcher got there. He continued to piss himself and throw up. And that's when the chef was like, "What's going on? We should, let's take a break." And then we left all our laughter out. And then again, I remembered we both had the chicken and waffles. And yeah, I was very scared for the rest of the day. Didn't really know if I was going to be in the same situation. And I wasn't, but I didn't want to. Thank you.
Some unsolicited advice for all men: be careful of the length of your shorts.
This program was made possible by the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, striving to enrich the quality of life of San Antonio residents and visitors by creating art programming and helping people experience art. For this and more information, visit getcreativesanantonio.com.
Our last storyteller is Mac McDowell. Mac shares a story about a shipwreck he'll never forget.
"That's not the first time my name has been mispronounced often. It's reservation for Mr. McDonald? No, McDowell. Anyway, I understand that you all want to hear the story about the mystery of Caroline Island. Well, that took a long time. That took place a long time ago. I remember it well because I was there. You see, I was on my first ship, and that ship was a research ship, full of all types of scientists, from oceanographers to ornithologists. And we were steaming from Honolulu, Hawaii, to Papeete, Tahiti. I know, tough duty, but somebody had to do it. We were a little ahead of schedule, and the ornithologist went to the captain and said, 'I'd like to stop off at Caroline Island to do a bird population study.' And we would have been the first people there in over 20 years. Or so we thought. As it turned out, I was going to be the watch officer when we actually made landfall on this island. And early in the morning, I went up to the bridge and got my briefing, and attached to the briefing book was a message from the Coast Guard about a missing sailboat called the Albatross. It was a blue hull, white top, missing sailboat for about 2 weeks. I put that in the back of my mind and continued on with my duties. It wasn't very long after that that the island came into view on the 24-mile scale of the radar. So I called the captain and I said, 'The island is about 24 miles away, which means we're going to be there in about 1 hour. Well, it was after about an hour, the island did come into view. I had other duties on the bridge, but my lookout shouted, "There's a boat on the beach." And I went, "What?" So I looked through my binoculars, and indeed there was a boat on the beach, and it had a large gaping hole in the side. It had a blue hull and a white top, just like the Albatross. So I called the captain, and he said, "All right, I'll be right up." And he's looking at it, and he's thinking, "Okay, we are in either a recovery or rescue mission mode." He calls the ship's doctor and tells the ship's doctor to pack a medical bag and body bags. He orders the boats over the side, and they weave their way through the reef to the beach of Caroline Island. Now, they can't get all the way up on the beach, so they stop the boat just as far as they can go, and they jump out in the ankle-deep surf. Well, that was like ringing the dinner bell for the black-tipped sharks. They surged out of the surf to try and grab my shipmate's ankles and pull them in for dinner. No one was hurt, but also nobody wanted to go swimming. At the same time, the doctor jumped off the boat and started running towards the wrecked sailboat to see if there was a body there or bones or what. He gets there and he sees it has Alaskan registry. He copies down the registration number, and then he notices it is not the Albatross. The name on the boat is the Petrel, completely different boat. He sees inside the boat, everything's been stripped. The compass, the electronics gear, even the boom from the mast was stripped. So somebody had survived this wreck, or somebody else had scavenged it. Meantime, the operations officer ran into the interior of this atoll and found an abandoned campsite. So there really was a survivor. There was a collapsed lean-to. There were empty tins of food on one side of the campsite and nicely organized full tins of food on the other side. And in and amongst all this flotsam and jetsam, he spots the sailboat's log. He picks it up. He sits down underneath a coconut palm and begins turning the pages of this weather-beaten log. October 2nd, 2 years before we got there, there's one entry. Shipwrecked! Exclamation point. Then the following pages are saying things like, survival's a problem, freshwater's a problem. Ultimately, he solved the freshwater problem by stretching the sails of his sailboat out on the beach to catch the daily tropical rainfall into the empty tins of food, and so freshwater was no longer a problem. He was using his ankles as bait to club the sharks as they came in to try and grab his ankles, and he was eating a lot of shark meat. But there's a problem with eating an apex predator in the tropics. You can end up with something called ciguatera poisoning, which makes you go mad. And on one of the following pages, he says, I think I'm going mad. I want to go home. I want to be home by Christmas. Then a page is divided into two sides. Reasons to stay, reasons to go. There's plenty of food, plenty of fresh water here. Ships don't come by here. I'm never going to be rescued. And then he starts drawing a diagram of a raft. And the last entry in that logbook was, the raft is loaded and ready to go. A decision must be made. We assumed that he had put to sea, never to be heard from again. We took the information of the registry back to the ship. We radioed Coast Guard Honolulu, who then radioed Coast Guard Anchorage, where it was registered. And the duty officer there in Anchorage had the unenviable task of picking up the phone and saying, after 2 years, the only thing that's been found is a derelict boat and a weather-beaten log. But who should answer? The captain of the Petrel himself. He had been rescued by the French ship Coriolis, and we were all elated. But aboard ship, everything becomes routine. We had to now change our course back to Tahiti. And as we were steaming south, I go up on the bridge again to take my watch, and there, still clipped to the briefing book, is the message from the Coast Guard about the lost vessel, Albatross. Whereabouts were still a mystery.
A memorable wreck indeed, but this one has a happy ending.
This program is made possible by the Lifshutz Foundation, an arts, culture, and humanities fundraising organization.
Worth Repeating relies on supporters like you. Supporting your favorite programs is important now more than ever. I ask you every show, and now I'm asking you every podcast. If Worth Repeating is a program that you turn to with fidelity, consider becoming a new or increasing your sustaining membership. You can do so by visiting tpr.org and clicking the red donate button today. You can leave a personalized note and tell them Tori said, meow, 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 meow. that's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and give us a like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Support for Worth Repeating comes from the 8020 Foundation, the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, and the Lifshutz Foundation. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.